This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Comedian Bill Maher has been setting the boundaries for comedy-based political talk shows for more than two decades. It all started in 1993 with his first talk show, Politically Incorrect. As the host, Maher specialized in biting political humor, and he's created a reputation that has followed him to his latest Emmy-nominated program, Real Time with Bill Maher. Along with being an acclaimed television personality, Bill Maher has written four best-selling books, starred in one of the highest-grossing documentaries of all time, and still tours quite rigorously as a stand-up comedian. Bill Maher performs at the Durham Performing Arts Center on Sunday, August 9th, but joins us first on The State of Things. Bill Maher, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. I said it all started in 1993, but it started for you in the late 70s with stand-up comedy. Tell us about your origins in stand-up.
Yes, 1979. I was fresh out of college and moved to New York City, where the urban clubs had taken root, and there was a kind of a renaissance of the kind of comedy that we've come to expect in years since, but we were kind of at the vanguard of that. I think before that, comedians got their seasoning in the Catskills and you know, places like that. But this was a new kind of comedy, and those years were great. I mean, they were also tough because, you know, comedy is a hard thing to get going. You know, it's not like sitting in front of the computer learning something. You have to get in front of people and actually make a fool of yourself night after night. But, you know, we were young, and we had such a fun time in it together. Some of those guys are still my friends, and some of them are still comedians, but not most.
Well, you say we. Who was in that cohort?
Well, Richard Belzer, Jerry Seinfeld, Paul Reiser, Kara Leifer, Larry Miller. Those were the people I remember in New York. Out on the West Coast, there was the Comedy Store. I mean, a little before my time, we're talking about the 70s, Leno and Letterman were out there. And, of course, Robin Williams and Richard Pryor, they all worked the Comedy Store. And then, you know, we all eventually migrated out to the West Coast because that's we all, back in the early 80s, we all had this template in our head that you get on Johnny Carson, you do four or five Johnny Carson shots, clean, good material, then they give you a sitcom, and then you're on your way.
It's easy. What kind of material were you doing when you weren't auditioning for Carson?
Well, I mean, at that point in your career, you're just trying to sustain the oxygen of laughter on stage. So basically anything that would get a laugh. I mean, I always gravitated toward the kind of material that I love to do, which, of course, is political, social, stuff that matters, big ideas, religion. I was never the comic who was really interested in small observations, although if I stumbled upon one, I would do it. And that's what most comics do. They observe everyday life, pop culture. And that's great if you do it well, especially. But I always liked the other stuff. The problem with that is that when you're 23 years old, you just don't have the gravitas to pull it off. So the audience is kind of looking at you like, what the hell do you know about who should be president?
Well, talk about the difference, because I think it's probably safe to say most of our listeners know you from Real Time and then Politically Incorrect. That format that you created, which is certainly a comic in nature, humor's at the center of it, obviously, but it's different than stand-up. How so? Is it a big change for you when you do one show and the other, when you do your stand-up or your sort of panel shows?
Well, I mean, they certainly are different. I mean, the stand-up is pure, you know. The talk show, Politically Incorrect first, which was a sillier show, but still was a show that tried to mix, you know, humor and national affairs. And the show I've been doing now for the last 12 years on HBO, they're hybrids, you know. I mean, I start with a comedy monologue, but then we have a panel, and panels that can be serious. I mean, there are moments of seriousness, certainly. We mix in comedy bits during the show. You're right, it's an entertainment show on an entertainment network. But stand-up is just for getting laughs. Now, of course, the material, I mean, the subject matter of the material is similar. As I say, that's what I'm interested in. Politics, national affairs, what's really going on. I mean, that can broaden out to sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but it always has some sort of political element, something that you can chew on intellectually. It's just that when you do stand-up, you are there to make people laugh and laugh hard for 90 minutes until they can't take anymore. That's what they should be doing, is saying no mas. So they are different, but they do feed each other. I mean, I love it that I have a, as you say, a rigorous touring schedule, because I feel like I see the country like in a way so many commentators do not. Mm-hmm. Bill O'Reilly talks about America every day, and I don't think he moves anywhere from further than his Long Island home and his Manhattan studio. All these teabaggers are always talking about how they want their country back. Well, you know what? I see America, and by the way, it hasn't gone anywhere.
Do you? What about the rigors of the tour, though, and doing stand-up? 60 shows a year, am I right? You're still doing that?
Oh, at least, yeah, 60, 70, sometimes 80. I mean, yeah, the travel sucks, and you're always saying, why, Saturday morning, you're tired, and I'm like, why did I do this? And then you get on stage at night, and you go, oh, yeah, now I remember why I do this. You know, there is an element, we have to be honest, people who do stand-up comedy, I guess any type of performing, we have to be honest that, you know, we're kind of hooked. It is kind of a drug. It is sort of an addiction. There's a story about Bob Hope. I don't know if it's apocryphal, but somebody asked him apparently once, Bob, you don't need any money anymore and you're a legend. Why do you still go on the road? And he said, because the gardeners don't applaud.
Well, let's talk about the other shows, Real Time with Bill Maher and its antecedent or predecessor, Politically Incorrect. Those shows are, you know, panel shows, but it's kind of cross-section of individuals. Let's get a bunch of smart people, interesting people to talk about stuff and put them in a room and see what happens. What's interesting about that is that in some ways, and I don't know if you remember this, but if you remember shows like The Dick Cavett Show.
Of course.
Right. And even Merv Griffin, when he decided to counter program and not go head to head with Carson,
yep,
and said, well, I'm going to get, you know, newsmakers on. There was a moment in American broadcasting when there seemed to be some kind of appetite for that thing. It faded. It died.
That was my inspiration for Politically Incorrect, was those shows,
yeah,
when in the 60s, late 60s of my youth. I mean, I was 12 in 1968 when that's when I first remember becoming aware of politics. That was a very, very political year, the Democratic Convention in Chicago with the riots and Nixon running and Johnson quitting and Vietnam. And, you know, I was ripe to be interested. And you're right, there was these kind of shows, Dick Cavett. There was also, in New York anyway, David Susskind.
Right.
Which was a kind of a informational talk show. It had humor sometimes, but basically it was people talking about real things. There was, I think, Alan Burke, was that the name of the guy? There was Cup Show. Yes, it was a different era. I mean, my gosh, Johnny Carson in that era did not just a 90-minute show. At first he did an hour and 45 every night. But even when it was 90 minutes, the last 20 minutes was always an author. I mean, he was always talking to somebody like Gore Vidal or Norman Mailer, something you can't even imagine the talk show host today doing.
Well, and remember, all the guests were sitting on the couch and they could chime in, and now it's like, well, I don't have time for that. No. I'm just talking my book and I'm going to go, right?
No, you're absolutely right. That was the inspiration for Politically Incorrect, to try to bring back that idea. I mean, what I added to it was, those guys used to do a lot of theme shows where the people would be similar. I said, you know, let's have people from very different walks of life, different ideological viewpoints, but also different levels of intellectualism, different vocations, and let's put them together. So, look, Politically Incorrect, which was a absolutely purposefully designed train wreck, was sometimes, I think, you know, really inspired, because a train wreck is hard to turn away from. And sometimes it was just a train wreck. You know, the fans of it, and I still meet them, will say, you know, that was the beauty of it. And I agree. Now, I'm glad it ended and I went on to something that I think is more suitable to me being older. I like the show I'm doing now, which is not designed as a train wreck. And we never have stupid people on. I mean, we were absolutely okay on Politically Incorrect to book Bob Dole with Carrot Top. That was fun. That is just not what we do on Real Time. First of all, Politically Incorrect was every night. So we had to fill 20 seats a week. I mean, there aren't 20 intellectuals in America, probably. let alone finding them in a week. But real time is only once a week, three people, and, you know, it's pretty much the A-team.
Yeah, but I think you should make it a challenge. Book Carrot Top with one guest for a month and just keep the whole show going. It'd be kind of great. So let's talk about your documentary. Well, actually, religion. I mean, that's a big topic for you. You're very serious about it, outspoken. You challenge people in their faith. Talk about your feelings about religion and why you feel so strongly about it.
Well, because it's both stupid and dangerous and a ridiculous anachronism in the 21st century. I mean, we are 400 years past the scientific revolution. So it made sense before the scientific revolution for people to make up silly stories about questions that they could not answer. I get that. I understand why in the year 5 BC it made sense to think of gods and their sons and virgin births, and, you know, because they didn't know what a germ was or an atom or where the sun went at night. But we're not there anymore.
How do you keep religion? Has one of the things it has done is created, for better and for worse, a kind of guiding star and an ethos, right? There's ethical norms that have been created for people, for better and for worse.
Well, I don't know if that's really from religion. I mean, the Ten Commandments in the Bible, only two of them are laws: don't kill and don't steal. And I don't really think we needed a burning bush for that. The other eight are nonsense. The first four are all about God being a giant egomaniac, and no statues to him, and don't say God's name, and don't take his name, all this nonsense. One of them basically is about women being property. Adultery is a property crime in the Bible, because a wife is someone's property. I mean, the idea that we would get morals out of this old book of Jewish fairy tales that is, when it's not being absolutely amoral, it's ridiculous. If it's not talking about God wiping people out for no reason, it's talking about somebody who lives inside of a whale. There is absolutely no defense in the 21st century for using this as anything but a doorstop.
Well, my question is, though, is that there's been a lot of harm done in the name of religion, without any doubt. But then the question is, without it, and I'm not saying it's the only answer, but without it, where do we get these guiding principles? Because really there have been, if in the 20th...
Ethics.
That's the thing, Bill. Whose ethics? That's the problem. It's the same with whose religion. There were two experiments in state-sponsored atheism in the 20th century: National Socialism in Germany and totalitarian communism in the East Bloc. Great shakes for human rights.
I would disagree with that, because both of those instances, which I've heard cited many times, they were actually state religions. Take the Emperor Hirohito in Japan, World War II. They thought he was a god. After World War II, one of the conditions of surrender was that the emperor had to go on the radio and tell the people of Japan, you know what, I'm not actually a god. People thought of Hitler godlike. Stalin created the same cult of personality. We see it in North Korea. Kim Jong-un and his father and his grandfather create this cult. Kim Jong-un, you may have read this, was born, when he was born, winter turned into spring, even though it was 3 months early. The first time he played golf, he got 11 holes in one. And people actually believe this, because there's no outside influence. They can't get the internet or anything, so they can't check on it. So they're brainwashed into believing this. Yes, they are different than the traditional religions, but they are in essence the same idea. When reality leaves the building, anything is possible.
Let's talk about the 2016 presidential race. Plenty of candidates to choose from. Do you like any of them?
Well, I like Hillary. You know, when people say, are you ready for Hillary? I always say, you know, that's the exact right slogan, because that describes how I feel about Hillary. Am I enthusiastic? No. I'm ready. I'm ready for Hillary. Like when the doctor says, I'm going to give you a shot. Are you ready? Yes, I'm ready. You know, Bernie Sanders, I know they're very excited on places like MSNBC that he's going to get the nomination. That, of course, is never going to happen. But I love it that he's forcing Hillary to go more to the left, because I think Bernie has the right ideas. And the closer she gets to those ideas, the more I like her. The Republicans, of course, are great for comedy, so I have to love them for that.
They'll keep the stand-up going for you. Don't you think it's time in America that for the Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump race. I mean, let's have it out, America. Let's do the billionaire capitalist and the socialist guy once and for all. Let's settle this argument.
I agree. I mean, we have had, certainly in my lifetime, really no left wing in this country. We have had a center-right party, that's the Democrats, who, by the way, were brought there largely by Hillary's husband, Bill Clinton. And we've had a far-right party that just gets farther and farther and farther right. So I think what we would love to see, people like me would love to see, that we have not seen, is an experiment with left-wing politics. I love it that Bernie Sanders is not afraid to say he is a socialist. He's not afraid of that word, nor should he be. We've had socialism in America for 100 years. And what did the people who are getting and loving Medicare and Social Security think that is? It's socialism. And by the way, the biggest socialism in America is the Pentagon. We constantly are making planes, tanks, submarines that the Pentagon themselves say they don't want and don't need. This is why police departments look like the military now, because the Pentagon gave it to them because they didn't have any place to store it anymore. Why do we make these things? Because we need them? No. We make them because it's a jobs program, a government-sponsored jobs program, otherwise known as socialism.
Bill Maher, the host of Real Time with Bill Maher, airs on HBO. He's coming to Durham Performing Arts Center Sunday, August 9th. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
To find out more about today's show, you can visit our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Andrew Tye, our intern. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.